that period of time, the city, in order to get away from your brick pavement, they had an innovation of using wood blocks. And they were about the size, what you see now, the Brazil paving block that you see in the streets now. And these were had been treated with creosote. And they were, in the summertime, they would be, would bleed, you might say, and some of this creosote would come out and it would be tacky and get on your shoes. Well, it was a very, very good idea from the standpoint of the thought that was back of it. It made a very quiet street for the shoes on the horses and the carriages. In other words, you wouldn't get that harsh clanking sound that you would normally get from on the brick pavement. Now, that was before they started to use concrete, or as we know today as pavement. So the theory was great. And the one street that I remember quite well was East Prairie Street. Now, the downtown streets were paved with this, but East Prairie Street particularly, if you remember, there were some very elegant homes east of West or North Main Street. The in the first block west, of course, was the old YMCA, which is on the same location where the new one is. There was, on the north side of the street in the same block, was the Christian Science Church. It was quite an interesting little building. And some of the buildings were torn down when the Decatur Club was built. But going back to the pavement, as I say, it had its advantage of quiet. But after a few years, after the creosote had more or less worked its way out of the wood, about the only way they had to hold the blocks in was to be to use hot tar. Well, that was good, except when a rain would come, say 2-3 inch rain or an accumulation of water, the blocks would become water soaked, and they would start floating around the street. Well, that they would try to put it back, but still, after a bad storm, it would be miserable trying to ride down the street, even in a horse and buggy, because the blocks would be all over the street. And it came to an end. I don't know what years they started to take the blocks up, because it was not a practical venture, a permanent venture. And the particular reason I mentioned the 100 block West Prairie, west of there, which we now have, well, it's the block where the Presbyterian Church is located. A little west of the Presbyterian Church is a very low spot. And actually, there is a huge drainage ditch, or tubing that was put in underneath the street, because at one time there was a creek that ran through there. And even as late as possibly in the period of 1920s, I would say, over on Main Street, directly south of this area, there was a little house in there that was occupied by the tailor shop. And I'll think of the name in a minute. And there was a bridge across the walkway there. And it's the drainage that comes from over around the Polar Ice Company. It drained all through, and there was an open ditch there. And of course, as the city grew and occupied more land to the west, they started to fill that in. And that is the reason for these large water drainage tunnels that they have in there. And, but in that particular spot, that was a prime target for the tile to float, because the water many times that filled the street. So that was quite an experience, but it was a wonderful thing for the carriages in the early days when it was first put down. Yes.
Do you remember the streets in winter? Were there problems with the streets in winter?
Yes. About the only streets that would be actually cleared would be north, we'll say North Walker Street, North Edward Street, West Main Street, and if you think now in correlation, those streets had streetcar tracks. So during the night, if we have a snowstorm, and during the day, the streetcar company had a great big brush on the front of a streetcar, and it would be the width of a track. So they would play up and down the streets that had car tracks.
Very good.
And then, of course, it would be around North Main Street, around the old transfer house, south to Wood Street, and of course the interurban station was located in the 100 block East Wood Street, so that area would have been cleaned. And then South Water Street, and then west or east on Wood Street would be the Riverside track going out. So those streets would be clean. So if you were a pedestrian, and of course in that period of time, many of the cars were, if you possessed a car, you did not drive it. You jacked it up and put it on blocks. So you would depend on the streetcar, basically, as your local transportation. And then if you walked, the idea was to get over to a street where the car tracks might be.
And you walked in the car track?
You walked in the street, mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, the city was a benefactor.
Oh, yes. Now, in that same period of time, occasionally, the city must have possessed a few plows, because the sidewalks would be cleaned by a horse-drawn plow. And this the driver would go up and down the sidewalks in given areas. Now, on the in that period of time, of course, Millikan University was in part of the area that was habited with modern homes and such. North of Grand Avenue, there was some, but by the time you got out to the Illinois Central Tracks, you were out in the country. So your area, which the man would plow, the sidewalks, was rather a limited area. It wasn't an expanse like we think of it in the town today.
But there were a lot of horses, weren't there?
A lot of horses.
And people could get through with horses.
Oh, yes. And it was not unusual at all to have someone hear sleigh bells going up and down the street, and with someone with a sled, mm-hmm. or a sleigh. Mm-hmm. And one of the sad things in that period of time, speaking of horses, see, the homes were heated by coal or wood, basically coal. And most of the coal was mined here in Decatur, most of it. Now, not all of it, but some. And my, what a dirty, dirty a mess it was. You could tell every time anybody would fire up the furnace because the black smoke would just roll out of the chimneys. So in order to supplement the heat or provide, the driver of a team would go to the coal mine, load up his wagon, and he'd start out. And as I mentioned before, one of the sad things on the days when the snow became packed, to see a horse fall when he was hitched to a wagon.
Slick,
yes, and particularly when there was ice of any kind. And occasionally you'd see a driver just whipping the horse and beating the horse, trying to get him to get up. But it was one of the sad things that happened at that time.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other memories of streetcars anytime?
Oh, yes. During the summer, they had open streetcars. Mm-hmm. And if we had summers like we had this past year, which was terribly, terribly hot, no air conditioning, of course. You provide your own. If you had a fan with you, that would be about it. Then you would take your handkerchief and wipe your brow. So in order to relieve the intense heat, we did have these open streetcars. And it was quite the thing to, even on when they were crowded, you'd see pedestrians or passengers standing on what we would say a running board. And then the conductor would go up and down and collect the fare. So you had two people. You had the motorman and you had the conductor. And the conductor's problem or business was to collect the fare. And the seats ran from side to side. They were benches, basically benches. And a lot of them were fixed so the backs were reversible, like you maybe you have seen some in elevated cars in the cities today. They have it. So if the car, they'd always pull the seats to the reverse if you were going to go in the, in order you would be facing the direction that you would be going. And they, many of them would be changed that they, when they, where the streetcar would stop. Now speaking is one thing in common with the streetcar. You take on many of the lines, they didn't have any way of turning them around. So the conductor or the motorman would get off or out of the car and get the trolley, pull it down, and walk around the car and hitch it up to the power line up above.
In the reverse direction.
For the reverse direction.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And of course, speaking of that, one of the devilish things at Halloween time would be boys, we'll say. I don't think there were girls involved in things at that time, maybe so. But they would trip the trolley so the streetcar would lose its power. And about that time, by the time the conductor would get off, why the boys would hide behind them. A tree or such, so they couldn't be found. But that was a stunt that a lot of them would pull.
Do you remember anything about the first automobiles in town?
I remember the very early ones. Now, the first car that appeared, of course, and was before my memory a little bit. But the cars were, in most cases, they were touring cars or roadsters. In other words, that would be a folding top. Mm-hmm. A little later, they did introduce, of course, the sedans. And most of those were would be rather a luxurious car and beautifully upholstered because you see that was a carryover from the days when they made carriages. And like Studebaker, an automobile company up at South Bend, basically that was a wagon works originally, of course, and then they went into cabinet work and building coaches. And many of the, let backtrack just a little bit, the earlier cars, of course, had tires that were very, should I say, stood at least, I would say, 36 inches in diameter. Mm. They were very narrow or very thin. So you think of it as a bicycle tire shape today. In other words, the advent of the soft sided tires did not come until after World War One.
What they called at first balloon tires.
Yes, yes, yes. Now these old tires, you had a, if you bought a set of them, you might have, get 6,000 miles on them.
Were they inflated?
Inflated with inner tubes. And you always carried in your early cars a tire repair kit. Because you see, when horse and wagons were in vogue, we had a lot of trash being hauled down the street, and a road, a country road, there would be a lot of nails that would be left in debris, because it was still a carryover from the horse and buggy days. And it was the thinking of the people using an automobile that was out in another field, you might say. So it was very common on these early tires to, like if you drive to Springfield, you might have one or two punctures on the way over there.
You'd have to stop and repair.
And yes. Or if you didn't have a spare, but you'd have, in most cases, you would have to repair the inner tube. And there was no way of inflating them except by a hand pump. Now you take in weather like we had last summer when it was up in the hundreds, and you have a flat tire, and you try to pump up one of those tires, and they carried, if I remember right, they carried around 40 or 50 pound pressure. So there was a lot of pressure that went underneath. And of course, when a tire did go out, it made a tremendous noise because the amount of air that was in built up on the inside of the inner tube. Speaking of that early cars, the advent of the self-starter was a tremendous advantage because, you see, up to that time, the cars were started by a crank. And the cranks, in most cases, were part of the equipment that was fastened on into the front of the car, beneath the radiator. And the Ford cars had a kickback of compression, and it was very, very common to see a farmer or a man on the street with his arm in the slings, usually the right arm. Basically, that's the one that he used to crank the car. Also, came out of the side of the radiator was a choke. So when you were trying to start the car, why, you would attempt to possibly pull the choke on it a couple of times to try to start it. The one big advent that came along, and of course this is rather recent when you stop to think about it, oil in cars, we didn't have winterized type of oil. And since, even like today, when it got down in the teens, the oil became very thick, and it was like very thick molasses. And it was literally almost impossible to start a car unless you had some heat involved to warm the motor up a little bit to the, to thin the oil. This advent of having oil like 1040 or 1030 or whatever the mixture might be, that is rather recent, and it's something that has not been around too long. So it does make cars much easier to start in the wintertime.
Oh, great. Of course, as you mentioned, some people just gave up their cars in the winter.
Yes. Now, the other thing at that period, those early cars, they didn't have electric lights on them. They used gas, and it was created by a little carbon contraption that was on the running board usually, and they used gas to light the cars, the headlights, and the taillights in most cases had kerosene to light the taillight. It's a little lamp. So when the advent of the electrical storage battery came along, that was a great, great improvement. Because when the cars had these carbon lights, they go over a chuck hole, like I spoke of the bumps in Prairie Street, it would knock the flame out. So in order to have light, you'd have to stop and restart your headlights again. So we've made a lot of changes from those early cars. And of course now those, the one big change, I mentioned it, most of the cars were touring cars. So in the wintertime, you had, if you did have your car out, you would put side curtains on. Now that was made out of a material very much what you could, like, would say vinyl today. It was basically an oil cloth, or a heavy oil cloth type of material. And it had little glassine strips in it to let light inside the car. So you would, most of the early cars were touring cars. So there was a period when the hard top came out, and it's very much like you buy a hard top for a truck today. You could mount these on top of your car to replace the soft folding back that came equipped with the car. And that was a big step towards a sedan or a closed car.
Even so, the cars would be very cold in winter, wouldn't they?
Very cold. And about all the heat that you had would be for off of the manifold. And many of the early cars had what they call a manifold heater. And you had no way of controlling it except opening the hole so the heat would come from the a pipe that was not attached to the manifold, but picked up the heat, radiated the heat through this pipe to the dashboard or underneath the dashboard, to the floorboard in the front. And of course you could drive from here to Booty and still the car would hardly get warmed up. But once it did get warmed up, you had only one way of controlling it. If it was too much heat, you just had to cut it off. But the early cars were, they were very, very cold. Now back in about 1928, BorgWarner came out with a new heater to put inside of the car. And it was a gasoline burner. It was very condensed. I would say maybe a very highly dangerous type of thing, but it was actually, they burned gasoline in it. But it was a very efficient heat and very quick heat. As a matter of fact, you could start your car and just turn this on and ignite it, and you would have heat immediately. Basically, it's a little bit like these heaters that people are buying today, the auxiliary heaters
for their homes.
But it was basically that same theory.
Dangerous?
It would be dangerous because although the fumes on this did not get into the inside the car, but the fact that you had gasoline burning in this little furnace, you might say.
It would be dangerous.
Yes. Back in the period of, say, around World War period, I mentioned before that...
excuse me, you mean World War One?
World War One. That is correct. The sedans or the cars with glass enclosure, there were some of them. And I can remember one that always made quite an impression on me as a little boy. My father had his shoe store on East Main Street, 148 East Main, and across the street, some of the buildings are still there, and yet many of them have been taken down or removed. It's where the Mutual Home and Savings buildings are located. The Powers brothers had, the family basically, I believe, would be landowners. And why the brothers would come down to the office quite regularly, mid-morning, and they, particularly in the wintertime, picture was so impressive. Each of them wore a very heavy coat with a fur collar. And many of them would have a fur hat. And this was a form of a limousine. There was a chauffeur. And when the car arrived in the middle of the block on 100 East Main Street, the chauffeur would get out and open the door, and four of the Powers brothers would exit. And it was, they were dressed like they were going to an opera. And they had one of the early limousines in town. With the chauffeur. Also, I spoke of Mrs. Baldwin earlier, that the house is now still in the 400 block on West Main Street. It's a little white house. She had a chauffeur. And you could always tell Mrs. Baldwin, I think I referred to this before, dressed in white. And her coach, or her limousine, either would be white or very, very light shades of gray. In other words, they were very delicate colors. Now, during that same period, people that could afford had a different type of a coach. Now, this would be for the ladies of the family. It was the electric car. Now, they couldn't travel very far, and they were not capable of plowing through snow or anything. It had to be on a dry surface and a rather flat surface. They could do their shopping, go visit Mrs. So-and-so, make some house calls, and come home, because the car was limited as how far they could go. But these were rather boxy coaches. You have seen pictures of the carriages that the very wealthy kings and such, that the men would pick up and carry on their shoulders, two in front, two in back, and they'd pick up the carriage. Well, they were shaped very much like that, except it had four wheels, of course. And the batteries would be, there were a little box affair on the front and in the back. And they were, you'd have to charge them up before you could go to the grocery store again or go shopping. But this leads to something else about that same period of time. It was quite the thing for families to order their groceries over the telephone.
Very good.
And it was very common to see a number of grocery stores having their wagons that they would deliver the groceries. And if you would be a person of means that could afford it, that was a thing to do, is to order your groceries over the phone. And we still have stories on television about boys playing the part or men playing the part of delivering groceries. But it was very much the same as what we have now with the laundry business. Like if you have a dry cleaning establishment, they would deliver your dry cleaning. Would that be the same with the groceries? There was that period of time of 1918, not too many of the streets would be year-round streets. You could run off into a mud street very easily. For example, Grand Avenue, which we think of as a main thoroughfare today, about Grand Avenue, there was only one street north of Grand Avenue that had any brick on it. That was up at, name slips me what it is, but Grand Avenue was just about as far north of where you had east and west streets that would be paved.
But you said Grand Avenue was not?
Was not. And when that was paved, that made quite an improvement. Leafland Street was not paved. And Packard Street was paved. Over to Van Dyke. Going west, West Main Street was paved out about as far as Linden Avenue. From there on, it became a clay road, maybe oil. And one of the tests in buying a new car back in the period of 1918, and that 1618, would be to take the car on out over the Snake Hill, which is the bridge going over Stevens Creek. Now, if you could go across the bridge and go up the hill on the other side in high gear, you had a pretty good car. I mean, in most cases, you would have to shift gears to go up the hill, maybe in second or even in low, in order to get up the hill.
Of course, none of these cars had automatic transmission.
No. You had to shift the cars. And there were a number of them that had the gear shift on the left-hand side of the driver, and it was actually exposed to the elements.
Outdoors?
Yes. And of course, Henry Ford made a big innovation because he was able to shift gears by using these pedals on the inside. And that, of course, was great help.
Do you mean people would reach outside the car?
Yes, and they had levers, the brakes as well as to the gears.
Oh.
So by bringing the gears on the inside was certainly an innovation. That was a great thing. Possibly one of the simplest and yet one of the most tools that was added or accessory was the windshield wiper that could be operated by a vacuum, which the original, most of them were operated by a vacuum from the motor. In other words, you couldn't turn the windshield wiper on until you started the car. Now, the early wipers were, you had to drill a hole in either in the windshield or the cabinet work above, the molding above the windshield, and there was a rod that came up and over the windshield back inside, and you had to do it by hand.
So pushed
it back and forth by hand. Practically all the cars were operated that way until these pneumatic and later on a little motors would be put into them. But that was something, trying to drive in a snowstorm or such with your car and trying to watch the intersections and trying to keep the windshield clean at the same time.
It helped to have somebody sitting next to you to push.
Oh my, yes, yes. Going back to the tires, as I mentioned, it was nothing. At 6,000 miles would be the ultimate in getting a tire. And there was a business of trying to retread them. People thought they could save money. Instead of buying a new tire, they would retread the old ones. Well, that was all right, and except on a hot day, the retreading would come loose, and you would lose your retread. Our family had an experience. We went down east one year and up into New England states. And one day we had 12 punctures.
Oh.
So you did learn how to vulcanize your tires, how to change them, and then pump them up. Mm-hmm. So if you'll look at pictures of the old pictures of people traveling on the old Pikes Peak Highway and such, you'd see where they would have a number of tires tied to the car. It wasn't anything unusual for a person to have four or five extra tires. And the reason, of course, is that your punctures were quite prevalent.
We've come a long way.
Oh, my, my. Now, you spoke of the transmissions.
Yes.
That came later, of course. And that was quite an innovation. Many people didn't trust them because you didn't have a definite control over the ratio of your acceleration as to your feel. In other words, you're relying on mechanical contraption there. And one thing that about World War II period of time, there was what they call freewheeling. And Studebaker had it on their cars, and it was quite a luxurious thing to have. You could be traveling down the road, and you could take your foot off the accelerator, and this thing, your car would just have, like putting the clutch in.
Mm-hmm.
It would disintegrate the motor against the wheels. In other words, the car would move on its own momentum. And of course, going down a hill, you had to watch it because you had to depend altogether on your brakes to stop a car.
Well, we certainly have come a long way with automobiles. What do you remember about entertainment in those days? For example, did you ever go to amusement parks in Decatur? Was there a place called Dreamland?
Dreamland, yes. As a matter of fact, there is a little reminiscence of Dreamland Park, which is the pond where the ducks are. And that was part of the old Dreamland Park.
And that's all that's left?
As far as I know, I don't think any of the other buildings are left. It's up there approximately where the tennis courts are located.
Yes.
And in order to get there, you took the streetcar, the West Main streetcar, and you could go out to the park out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a roller coaster, I can remember that, and then they had as I remember, a kind of a boat affair that you scooted down into the water there at the lake. And in other words, you were inside of a roller coaster type of a contraption. So that was quite a thrill. Matter of fact, there was another amusement park out at Riverside, which would be in the vicinity of St. Mary's Hospital, approximately in that area. But there was an amusement park out there on the river.
Did you ever go to the Corn Carnival? Now, of course, you probably weren't the age. It was earlier than your boyhood, I believe, but they did revive it one time in 1914 when you were 6 years old, you said, I believe, but you didn't go.
I went to some carnivals. Now, I can't tell.
Corn Carnival, where they had the decorations in corn.
No, I don't remember that.
Well, you must have missed that. According to what I have read about it, it was in the 1890s up until 1902. Then it was closed until, but one time brought back in 1914.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't, it wasn't successful, so they didn't continue it. Do you remember the circuses?
I was going to mention that, you speaking of the carnival. It was quite an event when a circus came to town. There were a number of them. Of course, the one that the name today is Barnum and Bailey. There was Sells Floto. There was a number of them that wintered up in Indiana. And of course, the circuses travel by train, and they use flat cars to pull their wagons on. And many of the early circus wagons were most ornate, and if any of you might have the privilege of seeing them up in Wisconsin yet. Beautiful, just beautifully crafted, carved wagons. The ones where the lions and the tigers would have cages, and I believe I'm correct in saying when the circus got back to the circus grounds, why the animals would be kept in these wagons until they would be transported or taken to the arena for their act. Now, it seems as if, in my memory, that we had more rains and storms when the circus would come to town, and many of them would be stranded in Decatur, because they would be in an area that their wagons would be bogged down by mud. And but they'd always try to have their circus show close to where their flat cars would be, so it wouldn't have to go such lengthy distance. But putting the tent up was quite a sight to see. And usually the circus train would get in town during the midnight or thereafter. Very likely they would be in Champaign-Urbana, and then they'd come over to Decatur, or they'd be in Bloomington and come down, or from Springfield. So the runs many times were not too great a distance. So they would hire many times I won't say bums, but people that were trying to pick up a quick dollar, they would go and help put the tent up. And it was quite a sight to see, and to go out and see the mess kitchens and to see the cooking equipment that you have to feed the people. Now, some of the actors and the actresses that would be of the higher paid or the stars of the show, many of them would have their own wagons that they would, or a Pullman car they would sleep in. And they would eat in the dining car like on the trains in those days. But it was the highlight of the circus, of course, was the parade. And you could always tell when there was a circus in town. People from miles around would come to town to see the circus. And they'd come early in the day to see the parade, and then they'd hang around because the show would start maybe at 1 o'clock. And then they'd have another show in the evening at, I assume, around 7 or 7:30. And as far as business in town, usually you could tell when a circus in town because there would be no one in the stores. Everybody would be going to the circus.
Well, that was a time that was really fun. Did you ever hear of an event called the Poor Man's Picnic in Decatur? Somebody mentioned to me that there was an event called the Poor Man's Picnic. Children would be given money to buy certain things. You never heard of that?
No, I don't recall that.
Did you ever hear of a Polish picnic?
Well, I don't know what you're referring to, but I remember very distinct. This town was very definitely divided ethnically.
In what way?
Well, there was a German settlement. I think I referred to this earlier. Very strong Irish settlement. We had a very strong, Polish people were gathered together, and they more or less had their own little society.
So they probably did have their
picnic. Oh, yes. Matter of fact, out on North Jasper Street, around Condon Street, out in there, there was quite a few Polish families out in that area, very definitely.
Well, was there any more entertainment that you recall? What about sports?
Well, we did have for many years, and of course that was after Mr. Staley became wealthy enough that he could sponsor. There was the ballpark at the corner of 22nd and El Dorado Street.
Baseball.
And when that happened, there was a flag on the transfer house. A pennant would go up. Baseball today. Yes. And
where did the teams come from?
Well, basically, I would say the old three I league. Davenport, I think, was involved in that. I believe Danville was in on it. Springfield was involved in that league.
Didn't
Peoria?
Didn't the three I's mean Indiana, Iowa,
and Illinois? So they did cover quite an area. But baseball was quite the thing. Football in the early days was a pretty much of a rough and tumble game. It still is today, but the players didn't have the protection. They had very little padding, and it was actually almost brute strength against brute strength. So it was many of them would come out damaged. Now, we did did not have the tennis courts. There were a few courts in town. The YMCA had a tennis court.
Well, if you would, if we can move on a bit, you had mentioned in your first interview your work at Linen Scruggs.
Mm-hmm.
In about the time 1914, where were they located? Do you know?
Yes.
Of course, you were just a boy then.
But they were located. Linen's had several locations. But after their fire in about 1914.
That's right. That's the time the Opera House burned.
That is correct. And
were they near the Opera House or in the Opera House?
The Opera House was located. See, the Hotel Orlando was built after that fire. Mm-hmm. And the Opera House was located approximately about where the entrance to the Millican National Bank building is today. It was in that area where the Opera House was located. I remember that fire.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yes.
Tell me about it.
Well, it was quite a sight. And
you weren't very old.
No, but I remember it very well.
Well, tell us.
The buildings, of course, all around were scorched, and the heat from it cracked windows on, I would say, a half a block radius. And it was a very devastating fire. So after that fire, Linen's rebuilt, and they had a very, very elegant store.
Where was that located?
And that is located where the Millican National Bank is at the present time. Linen's had a tea room in their building, very, very nice dining room, and in, I speak of it, there be the days when the ladies would wear black dresses with the little white aprons and very likely had a little white cap that they wore.
The waitresses.
So it was a very elegant place. And Lynn stayed there until the Depression is when they moved over to the location where the Quiggles Furniture Store is located now.
That was after the Depression of the 1930s?
Yes.
Is that when you worked for them?
Well, I didn't go to work for them until a little later on.
But you worked in that area?
Yes.
In that store.
Yes, yes.
Do you remember anything about the Tabernacle?
I remember went to go to see Billy Sunday.
Did you?
And the Tabernacle was located, to my memory, on East Wood Street in the vicinity of where St. Mary's Hospital was located, where the City Hall is now, or the police station, or the local police station. And it was a, they had sawdust on the floors, and they had benches. It was not chairs or seats, they were just benches. And in order to get air into the place, of course, they had to open up the sides of the tenting.
It wasn't a permanent building?
As I remember, it was constructed like a barn. It was very rough. And they had these drop sides. Now, I could be wrong on that, but as I remember, they were like sides to a tent. Curtains that would be dropped down to keep out the elements. But you take, say, you put 2,000 people inside of a crowded place like that on a hot summer evening, it would get pretty warm.
Especially with all that preaching.
Oh my, very highly emotional type of thing, very high. Yes, I remember going to it.
Do you remember any of the other details?
Well, I was trying to Homer. I was trying to think of his song leader. Rhody Heaver, I believe, was correct. And one of the things, oh, he had a beautiful voice, but it was about during that time that Homer Rhody Heaver would sing the song, which we still have in some of the books, The Old Rugged Cross. And it was quite a thrill to hear a crowd of people sing that song after he would sing a verse or so of it.
So it really was a successful event.
Oh my, it was a social event in the community, because all you had would be, you asked the question about the entertainment. A lot of people went to these for entertainment. You had your theaters, and the Empress Theater and the Bijou Theater had vaudeville. And then later on, when the Lincoln was built, that wasn't built until about the same period of time when Linda Scruggs had their fire in 1914. Now, I don't know the date on the building down there, but the Lincoln Theater was built approximately that same period of time. To go to one of these revival meetings wasn't a social experience to meet your friends, to go and spend the evening.
Do you recall when there were two phone systems?
Yes. The home telephone was one, and the other, I believe, was the automatic, or I believe was the name it was used. So if you happened to subscribe to one, and I didn't happen to have the same subscription to it, I couldn't call. So you had your little list of names of people that belonged to your phone. Now, when the two were put together, the merger must have happened about approximately 19. We'll say 1918, approximately World War time, when they started to consolidate that.
And again, we mean World War
One. World War One, excuse me. And up to that time, another form of communication, of course, was the Western Union, and the other was the Postal Telegraph. And they were located in the 200 block North Main Street. The Western Union was located approximately where Fields Apparel Shop is located. The Postal Telegraph was located across the street. And of course the Herald paper, Morning Herald, was a little bit north of the Western Union. So that area right in there was a source of communication. And matter of fact, I believe on one of those buildings were goods furniture. There's a embossed in the stone up there, telephone building. I believe the word is on there yet, Home Telephone Company or such. Excuse me. But speaking of the telegraph, in order to get a very speedy communication, you would send it by Western Union or Postal Telegraph. Now, when your communication arrived at its destination, you had a delivery boy, and it was quite the thing for young fellows. To earn some money was to work for the Western Union or the Postal Telegraph. And the boys would ride their bicycles. Now, in the wintertime, that would be quite something, like we were talking about the snow, when you had 2 or 3 feet of snow. And I would imagine most of those communications, the boys would have to walk to deliver them. But the boys made fairly good money, that is, at that time, delivering telegrams. And it was a scary thing to have a boy knock at your door after midnight. You knew it was either very serious or, many times, it was announcing a death of a family of someone in another town. But that was in that same location.
And then eventually the phone systems merged into one.
They emerged into one, yes. Which was a big, big help, of course.
It
benefited everyone.
Except the phone company that went out of business.
Well, you see, we failed to realize that your utilities were operated by small operations in the beginning. Now, speaking of that, you had the beginnings of the telephone, the beginning of the power companies, the interurban was a private operated affair, just like the railroads. We had something in Decatur in relation to utilities, which was unique. The Illinois Power Company, what we know now as the Illinois Power Company, had a steam generating plant on North Edward Street at what is now the Norfolk and Western tracks, what used to be the Wabash tracks. And they generated steam, and it was transmitted to the vicinity. I don't know if I mentioned this to you before. South of the tracks, possibly North Street would be as far west it went.
To various businesses.
And homes. And of course, that eliminated the firing of furnaces.
A great help.
Yes. But the part that was bad, if they had a breakdown, you were out heat and you did not have any other way of heating except by fireplaces or
coal oil stoves
and such as that. And they didn't start their heat until, we'll say, November 1st. And they cut it off, we'll say, April 1st. So if you had chilly days in the spring, you were at mercy of having auxiliary heat, and the same way in the fall. But much of the downtown property, businesses, were heated from the steam system.
Well, can you think of other such enterprises or businesses or entertainment? So anything that would show the changes that have come about?
Well, it's hard to believe. Many of us, of course, hated to see the old Stephen Decatur High School torn down. I speak of that because the auditorium in the old Stephen Decatur High School at one time was about as large a auditorium that we had for any public programs. Then, later on, after the Lincoln Theater was built, it was quite the thing to schedule your program for the Lincoln Theater. And of course, that meant you had to work in many, many months in advance for them to cancel their vaudeville show and their movie that they had scheduled. But I can remember of, as I say now, because the Lincoln Theater, I believe, would accommodate around 1,400 people, which was a pretty good size auditorium compared with the old high school. Now, Milliken had an auditorium, which we think of now as Albert Taylor Hall, but it was limited as to accommodation. But going back down to the Lincoln Theater, such shows as Paul Whiteman came to town. And that was when he introduced the, what's a common song to all of us, Rhapsody in Blue.
Oh.
And of course, he was not accepted by the